This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Hurricane Dorian is arriving. The Boeing 737 MAX is staying on the ground. Age discrimination in the tech industry. And hey, put down the fantasy football, people. We're working here. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, September 2nd, Labor Day, the end of summer. Thanks for joining us. We're going to start with Hurricane Dorian. It is approaching the U.S. coast. It has done catastrophic damage in the Bahamas already. In Florida, at least three airports are closed and more than 1,000 flights are canceled. Georgia and the Carolinas may also be hit. But for all the focus on the coast, there are a lot of inland communities in Dorian's path that are still suffering from previous hurricanes. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more.
Back in 2016, Nishant Abdelaziz was running a clothing store in Lumberton, North Carolina, a town about an hour and a half inland from the coastal city of Wilmington. Then Hurricane Matthew hit, flooding Lumberton with waist-high water. Abdelaziz says he didn't see it coming.
I wasn't even in a flood area. We didn't even have flood coverage.
His store went out of business, along with other stores in his shopping center. Abdelaziz says that part of town is still economically depressed.
A lot of people moved out and moved away, so it became a dead area.
There are a lot of inland towns and cities like Lumberton that are in the path of Hurricane Dorian. Jeff Slegomelch at Columbia University's National Center for Disaster Preparedness studies these so-called socially vulnerable areas.
It essentially comes down to your ability to marshal resources.
He says many of these cities have lower income levels. That's made it harder to rebuild after previous hurricanes, let alone navigate the complicated bureaucracy of aid programs. Residents are also less likely to be able to afford flood insurance.
And then you end up with this band of areas that are very rural and tend to be much slower in recovering from disasters.
Even when those disasters do only affect coastal areas, Alice Hill at the Council on Foreign Relations says coastal businesses often employ people who live further inland.
If their businesses that they're employed by close down, they may not be earning anything during the period of the storm.
Or the threat of a storm if a coastal city evacuates. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Now, I mentioned those canceled flights in Florida, which are happening as millions of people are flying for the Labor Day weekend. Air travel schedules have already been disrupted over the past several months because Boeing 737 MAX jet was grounded after two fatal crashes. And this weekend, United and American Airlines announced they'll keep the plane off their schedules until December, meaning that holiday travel was looking kind of ugly, folks. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
The Federal Aviation Administration temporarily grounded the 737 MAX last March after two fatal crashes. The FAA says it's not following a prescribed timeline for allowing the MAX jet to fly again.
A lot of it comes down to flight testing.
Richard Abulafia is an aviation analyst at Teal Group.
And, of course, getting all of the pilots that are invited to provide input comfortable.
A big question is how much pilot training the FAA will require in flight simulators. Abulafia says there are only 16 or 17 737 MAX simulators. With all this uncertainty, airlines are just taking MAXs off the schedule, which means extra scrambling during the holidays. Donna Rhodes teaches management at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University.
They really want the business. Airlines hate to turn away people asking for seats.
So planes flying into smaller regional airports will be diverted to more popular hubs. And airlines can lease older aircraft. But if there aren't enough planes, ticket prices could go up over the holidays. Haley Berg is an economist at the flight app Hopper. She says if grandmother's house is off the beaten path,
it will be more difficult on some of those more regional routes to find a seat on a plane or get a great deal price because there will be lower capacity.
Berg says you could pay 25% more than you did last year for a flight from, say, Pittsburgh to L.A. The upshot? You might have to fly at a different time or date than you planned to get the best fare. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, markets are closed in the U.S. for Labor Day. Global markets were mixed after yet another set of U.S.-China tariffs went into effect yesterday. More on all that when we do the numbers. Quentin Tarantino's latest film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, was a big hit this summer. It tells the story of an actor and his stunt double, and it really shows how much stunt workers contribute to Hollywood success by jumping off buildings, lighting themselves on fire, crashing cars. But even despite a long one-man lobbying campaign, the Oscars have never had an award category for stunt work. Bilge Ibiri writes for Vulture, and he tried to find out why. Welcome, Bilge.
Hi, nice to be here.
So tell me about Jack Gill, the stuntman you profiled for this piece, and then this quest that he's been on to create an award for best stunt coordination.
Well, you know, Jack Gill is a veteran stuntman and stunt coordinator, and it was in 1991 when he was working on a film called A Stranger Among Us, which was directed by the great Sidney Lumet, the director of films like Prince of the City and Dog Day Afternoon and 12 Angry Men. And Sidney Lumet basically said, all right, we're going to get you in the Academy and we're going to make this happen. You know, that was 28 years ago, and it hasn't happened since, and Jack Gill tries every year. And also, you know, a number of other stunt people have tried as well. He's not the only one. And, you know, this is something that a lot of people are starting to feel very strongly about.
Well, it seems like the direction that movies have taken seems to argue for it all by itself, right? That movies involve more and more stunts even now than they ever have.
Absolutely. I mean, more and more Hollywood is reliant on big action films or, you know, space fantasies, adventures, things like that. And very often these films require stunts. A lot of people will look at those and say, well, you know, they do it all with computers nowadays. That's not actually true. If you look at the end credits of these films, there are often more than 100, hundreds of stunt people credited at the end of, you know, a film like Avengers Endgame. And also the visual effects people, many of them have said, we wouldn't be able to do what we do without having great real-life footage created by stunt actors and stunt coordinators.
So what's the argument against it? Why hasn't the Academy let it happen?
The Academy has never said this is why we're not giving you this category. But obviously, I'm sure there are lots of people who say, well, the show's too long, we're trying to make things shorter, why would we add a whole other category to it? Jack Gill's response to that has been, listen, we would be perfectly happy with an award given during the ceremony that happens before the Oscars. Mm-hmm. Although personally, I would prefer to see the category during the actual broadcast because obviously the clips would be great. And anyone who's ever interviewed stunt people can tell you they are very entertaining speakers.
I'm sure.
Yeah. And there's also this other, you know, concern, supposedly they'll try and make the stunts more elaborate in an effort to win Oscars and, you know, people will get hurt and maybe even die. That is not a belief expressed by anybody actually in the stunt community because all of them understand that a stunt coordinator's number one job is safety. Like, that's what they're there for.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you argue in your piece is that this could come down to a bit of a class divide, right, in Hollywood when it comes to stunt workers and stars.
Yeah, it's almost kind of history. In the days when, you know, the movies, the silent films were Westerns, they were slapstick comedies, they were, you know, adventure serials, the people that were being cast in most cases weren't being cast because they were really good looking or because they could emote, but because they knew how to fall off a horse without injuring themselves or shoot a gun convincingly. I mean, you know, even though they were instrumental in helping build the industry, were often seen as disposable. In the 1920s, they were dying by the dozens. And, you know, over the years, they've grown in power and prestige. But there is still, especially among some of the, you know, the older guard, there is this sense that stunts aren't an art or a science, which is absurd. Anyone who's actually seen stunt people at work would tell you that it is actually both an art and a science.
Well, so the Academy did just elect a new president, David Rubin, last month. Do you think after working on this piece, we're any closer? Do you think we'll see an Oscar for stunt work at any point?
I hope so. You know, Jack Gill actually told me that he emailed my piece to the new president, so I don't know if he's read it or not. But this year, I think, because there's a film like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood out there where, you know, one of the key characters is a stunt double, even, you know, Hobbs and Shaw, the new Fast and Furious movie that's directed by a former stunt coordinator, they have become mainstreamed in a way, and they're more vocal. And I think, you know, maybe the fact that the Academy is itself is changing with a lot of newer members being brought in, that will help as well.
Bilge Ibiri is a writer and editor for New York Magazine and Vulture. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
Now on to another overlooked category of workers. The tech industry is known for its diversity issues around gender and race, but a lesser known blind spot is age. The average age for an American worker is 42, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But at the biggest tech companies, research shows it's more like 25 to 35. Kate Edwards is the former head of the International Game Developers Association. She came up with a way to celebrate experienced tech workers like herself with a list.
So my name is Kate Edwards, and I've been in the game industry for 26 years, so I am 54 years old. And one of the initiatives that I've been focused on is ageism. And I came up early in 2018 with this idea about doing a 50 over 50 list, just on a whim. And I was like, why can't we celebrate age? Why can't we celebrate wisdom and experience? At the advice of one of the people, which I won't name, but they're actually on the list, they said, you know, you might want to contact everybody and make sure they want to be on this list, because to have their name on a 50 over 50 list, that actually could double down on the ageism that they might be experiencing, because there might be people around them who don't know that they're that old. I reached out to them and I asked them, are you okay with this? And of course, I was super happy, because 100% were just like, absolutely, I don't care. Put me on the list. I think it's awesome. There's this general stigma or this misperception that older people, they get set in their ways. They're not into learning. The thing that I find interesting is in the fiction we consume so voraciously, you see older characters all the time. They serve a very important role in the hero's journey. They serve a very important role in narrative that we love. You know, the Oracle in the Matrix movies, Antiope from Wonder Woman. They served a very valuable role as a mentor and a guide. Why is it that same value that we place in older people is just not there in reality? And that disconnect has always been really kind of at the forefront. When I turned 50 years old, it was a week before the big game developers conference in San Francisco. So instead of having my 50th birthday at home, I deferred it to the next week. So our party became partially my 50th birthday party. And I did it for a point, because I wanted people to know that I'm 50 years old and I'm not ashamed. I mean, I already know I'm doubly challenged, because not only am I a woman in tech, I'm also over 50 now. But I want that to be emphasized. And I guess, in a way, that was sort of a kernel that led to me eventually creating something like the 50 over 50 list.
That's Kate Edwards. She's the creator of the Global Gaming Industry 50 Over 50 list. Coming up,
as you can see, they're golden brown, lovely, thin, crispy.
We are not talking chocolate chip cookies, people. Not even close. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed today for the Labor Day holiday. Global stocks slipped amid trade tensions. The U.S. and China just imposed new tariffs on each other's exports, and that stoked fears of a possible downturn in global growth and pushed down oil prices. Argentina's decision to introduce capital controls weighed on markets too, reviving fears around emerging market economies. In Europe, Britain's FTSE climbed 1%. France's CAC 40 added 0.2%. Germany's DAX advanced 0.1%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas. Loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Oh, hello, all tens of millions of you who are pouring through articles and statistics and rosters, preparing your fantasy football teams for Thursday's start of the NFL season. We see you. I mean, we literally see you, not working. While the business of fantasy football rakes in more than $7 billion for leagues and restaurants and bars and such, all that is a little offset by the total lack of productivity in the workplace. And Marketplace's Andy Euler is here to bust you again.
My cousin Kyle loves fantasy football. You could say he's a fanatic. So I asked him how much time he spends playing the game per week.
4 hours a day, 7 days a week, 28 hours.
He says most of that time is spent listening to fantasy football podcasts.
I listen to podcasts while I'm getting ready for work, and usually I'll be listening to podcasts throughout the day while I'm working.
He's a bit of an outlier, but he's not alone in spending time on fantasy football at work. According to a survey conducted by the lending firm OpLoans, most people who play do the same. Lane Koreska is director of content there.
96.6% of respondents reported spending time at their job working on their team. Nearly an entire 8-hour workday per week is lost to fantasy football.
Estimates put the number of fantasy football players at least 20 million. Andrew Challenger is vice president of the employment firm Challenger Gray and Christmas. He says that lost time means a lot of lost money.
Fantasy football could cost employers $9 billion in lost productivity.
Playing the game isn't cheap either. According to the Fantasy Sports and Gaming Association, 70% of fantasy sports players compete in leagues that charge a fee, and each player spends an average of $650 on fees each year. According to Lane Koreska at OpLoans, that number doesn't include the price some leagues charge if you come in last place.
Punishments included buying drinks or a meal for everyone else, hosting and paying for a Super Bowl party, and we actually did get more than one respondent reporting that their league forces the loser to get a tattoo of the winner's choice, although we never asked to see any photographic proof.
Lesson seems to be, if you're going to spend valuable time on playing fantasy football, at least make sure you know what you're doing. That reminds me, I got to get out of here. Got a draft in a minute. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
A lot more people are looking for alternatives to Facebook, but instead of using group chat or TikTok, what if you just built your own? Darius Kazemi is a programmer and artist who did just that. His is called Friend Camp, and he published a guide to building your own small-scale social media network. Darius, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so in a world where everything is provided to me in terms of social networking and chatting with my friends and finding some sort of group to talk to people, Why do you recommend that we should actually build our own?
Well, it's really about control over your own social network situation. So when you're signing on to something like Facebook, you are agreeing to play by their rules, which is fine. Maybe it's fine for you and your purposes. But to me, the problem is that Facebook has to make rules that work for a billion people. So you're going to end up with a kind of lowest common denominator set of rules. And I think those rules could be better if you just scoped them down to smaller communities. So that's why I'm saying small communities should have their own networks.
Who's this for? Who should do this?
You know, I think right now it's people who have safety concerns and really want to control where their information goes and who gets to see it. I think it's people who want to have a community with no targeted advertisements or algorithms that you don't control. And even if it's not like, oh, I personally have control over this sort of thing, it's my friend or this person who I know socially does have control. So I can go to them as opposed to having to try to get the attention of Mark Zuckerberg.
It sounds like you might be saying that maybe community doesn't need to be a business.
That is essentially exactly what I'm saying. I use the metaphor often of free public libraries as a kind of community mapping for this sort of thing. And to talk about the money side of thing, the way that I run FriendCamp is we just have a Patreon, but it's just a convenient way to collect monthly dues from people who are on FriendCamp. And people pay between $0 and $5 a month for their social media experience. And it doesn't cover my time as like a developer. You know, like if I were doing this for a job, I would want to be paid a lot more money for it. But because it's a service that I'm giving myself as much as anyone else, and the material costs of the hosting and the domain name and all that stuff are covered by the community.
And so what is the ultimate goal? Do you think it's to provide people with this alternative should they want it and have the skills to pull it off? Or do you hope that you will spark something bigger?
Yeah, the ultimate goal is I would like this to be an option for all sorts of people, not just people who know someone like me who is both kind of like technically and community savvy. So what I would like is for this kind of social media software to be available through, you know, for example, there's like WordPress. If you want a WordPress blog, there's like 100 companies you could go to that you can pay X dollars a month to, and they will host your WordPress blog for you. So I would like to see sort of the commoditization of the hosting of that sort of thing. My next goal is to run workshops. I already have a bunch lined up. So it's really like a person-to-person kind of knowledge dissemination.
I just love this. This feels like the internet that I grew up on.
Yeah,
it makes me want to like run my makes me want to run my own email server like the good old days.
Yeah, exactly. It's and you know, and I've tried really hard to kind of separate my own nostalgia from this too, which it's really helped like interacting with teenagers, as you said. You know, like when I talk to young kids, it's like, okay, cool. They want this thing too. It's not just me being like an out of touch old guy.
Darius, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for talking to me.
Darius Kazemi is a programmer and artist. His manual, How to Run Your Own Social Media Platform, can be found at runyourown.social. And now for a story about a food that might not be on your Labor Day barbecue menu, but maybe it will be next year. It's a snack that also reduces food waste and tastes delicious. A small firm on the coast of Northwest England is using a byproduct of the salmon processing factory next door to make chips out of fish skin. Just hang with us for the taste tests. Kaz Graham went to the town of Maryport to see the transformation in action.
So this department here is our goods in. We bring in 60 ton of whole salmon per week, the whole salmon with the head on and gutted.
Luke Maloney is operations manager at Grant's. They've been smoking Scottish salmon here, selling to a world market since the mid-1980s.
We remove the salmon's head, we remove the salmon's frame, and we create salmon fillets.
But there's one part of the fish they haven't been using, until now.
You put the fish on the belt, tail first, through the skinner, laid flat and placed in the tub.
That's the nice fillet in the tub. And where's the skin gone?
Skin gone underneath.
And there it is, shining away.
That's it,
in the bottom.
It.
It's very thin and shiny. Yes, it's been smoked, so it's cured. It's cured skin.
The amazing part is that we've been throwing these in the bin for 30 years, so it's excellent to see a solution to this.
That solution has come through working with Dan Pawson, who's using the skins to make sea chips, a crunchy, savoury snack.
The idea actually came from when I was a private chef and I was cooking for athletes and celebrities such as Kylie Minogue, and they're always looking for the next big kind of healthy snack. And what we found was that we were throwing away loads of salmon skin when we baked it. So instead we started to crisp it up and garnish dishes with it. And all my clients and customers used to love them. So sea chips was born.
There could be gold in them there skins. Market analysts Mintel predict the value of the UK market in crisps, savoury snacks and nuts will rise to £4.3 billion a year by 2021.
Here we have these salmon skins. They're now being laid out. We then take them over to our cooker. You can actually hear them now crackling as it hits at the 180-degree heat.
And at this stage, they are little squares, maybe, of what looks like, very obviously, salmon skin.
As you can see, they're golden brown, lovely, thin, crispy, totally descaled. So there's nothing yucky about them. They're all kind of clean-looking, neat-looking.
You can't get away from the fact, though, that this is salmon skin. It's fish skin. That is the thing that most of us push to the side of our plates going, I'm not so sure about that. How can you persuade people to buy snacks that are essentially fish skin?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways. One of them is definitely going down the kind of ethical road. You know, we're reducing masses and masses of seafood waste by making these crisps. And not only that, they're super high in protein. In fact, one of the highest protein snacks on the market. Packed full of omega-3, so great for brain function. So far, it's been going great. You know, we always get a really interesting reception from people. Some people do love it, some people hate it. But if we get one out of every 3-4 people like them, kind of, we're happy with that.
Well, I say the proof of the pudding is in the eating. So I've come onto Senhouse Street in Maryport to see what people think of them. I think he likes them.
They're a cross between a pork scratching texture, one of the bacon sizzler type snacks that you get.
They're quite nice, yeah.
They're made from salmon skin.
Salmon skin?
Salmon skin.
I don't like salmon skin.
Well, you've just said you like it.
I've got the dog in the front. Do you want him to try him? He can try him if you like.
In Maryport, on the northwest coast of England, I'm the BBC's Kaz Graham for Marketplace.
This final note before we go, the Los Angeles Times reports that it rained so much in California this winter that this year's crop of lemons are huge. But huge lemons are apparently not a good thing for producers. They can sell regular size lemons at the store for $30 a carton, but the big ones get turned into juice and that's only worth $18 a carton. Big lemon producers say they will lose millions on this year's crop. So I guess when life gives you giant lemons, please don't make lemonade. All right, we got to go. U.S. markets were closed today for the Labor Day holiday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk includes Eliza Mills, and I am Molly Wood. Kai Rizdahl will be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.